Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a lecture sponsored by the College of Arts and Sciences Honors Program titled The Future of Culture in the Age of Commerce, China and India. Speaking will be Dr. Vishakha Desai, President and CEO of Asia Society, a global educational organization dedicated to deepening connections among the peoples of Asia and the United States. Dr. Desai is introduced by Art History Department Chair Fred Kleiner. Professor Kleiner.
20 years ago, I had the privilege of introducing a senior scholar in my own field, whom I had met as a graduate student and who was about 20 years older than I was. And after I gave my introduction, during which I referred to him as an old friend, he came up to me and said that he had never been introduced in a more flattering way, but having just turned 60, he didn't like being referred to as an old anything. So now that I've reversed roles, I have the pleasure this evening of introducing a young woman whom I have known for many years. In fact, going back to 1981, when I had just become the chair of the art history department for the first time around. And I was upset by the fact that our department taught only the art of the Western world. It was not a philosophical prejudice per se. It had just sort of happened on its own. But we certainly didn't have the funds to go beyond that. But I was determined to do so. We were able to scratch together some money for a course here and a course there. And that is when I learned that at the very moment that I was becoming chair, the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston had just appointed a new assistant curator for South Asian art primarily. And it was, of course, Vishakha Desai. That is when we met. I was able to invite her to give a course each year for several years, and that was the beginning of our exploration of the vast world beyond the West. Now, 20, 30 years later, a lot has changed. That was long before there was even an honors program at Boston University. It is before we had a core curriculum. It was when I was the sole professor of ancient art at Boston University. We now have two ancient art historians and an entire archaeology department that didn't exist then. And we have within the art history department a specialist in Chinese art, in Japanese art, in the ancient Americas, in African art, and Islamic art. And we now offer a truly global curriculum, and it has been, frankly, a dream come true for me. This university has certainly matured. And so, too, in that period, of course, is our distinguished speaker. She has gone on from being an assistant curator at the MFA to teach at a host of distinguished universities, ours among them, Princeton, Columbia, the University of Massachusetts at Boston. She has curated innumerable exhibitions, produced some very important scholarship and catalogs on Indian temple sculpture, on the Rockefeller collection, just to name a couple. She has spoken at venues all around the world and of many different types. And she has, if I may insult myself, so to speak, matured beyond being a mere art historian to become one of the key players on the world stage in exploring the broader nature of Asian culture and the way the United States and Asia interact. Most recently, of course, by becoming president of the Asia Society since 2004. So it is a great pleasure for me, both personally and professionally, to introduce my young friend of many years, Vishakha Desai.
Thank you very much. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's a great pleasure for me to be back here at BU. And as Professor Kleiner mentioned, indeed, some 25 or more years ago, Asia was not on everybody's consciousness the way it is today. And I must say, as the head of the Asia Society, I often feel that we've been in existence for 52 years. And 52 years ago, people thought knowing about Asia was a good idea. I'll do it when I get to it. Today, not knowing about Asia, you do it at your own peril. And that's the reason I'm delighted to be here with you this evening. One of your colleagues and an academic a professor here mentioned to me that when he was talking to some of his students, and one of the students said, is she going to be like another one of those speakers who came and just basically talked about his book and flogged the book as part of the honors program? I do want you to know that I don't have any book to sell. However, I do have another selfish reason why I'm trying to do this talk today called Future of Culture in the Age of Commerce, China and India. It's because we at the Asia Society are beginning to look at this very topic, and it will become a major initiative. Now, I realize in the university parlance, initiative is not as good as the center. However, we are not going to make it a center. It will be only an initiative, and it's an initiative that also refers very much to the way we operate at the Asia Society. We are an unusual organization. Some of you may know us, some of you may not, but we're one of the few organizations I know that's committed to really strengthening partnerships with Asia across multiple disciplines. So I often say that our mission is to really have a three-dimensional engagement with Asia that combines culture, commerce, and current affairs. It sounds good, but the reality is it's not so easy to do. As all of you know, in the academic setting, disciplines are hard to break down, it's hard to cut across, and to have a conversation. So I, as the relative new president of the Asia Society now for 4 years, and the first president to come from the cultural side rather than from the political side to head this organization, am committed to really exploring the role and place of culture in these heady days of economic development, especially in China and India. And in my own personal experience, I have found that when I talk to my colleagues in the business world or in the political world, often there is this notion of keeping things pretty separate. And yet, we have to recognize that especially China and India are politically of one age, economically of another age, and culturally of yet another one. If you think about China economically, you might say that today's China, as we know it, really began with Deng Xiaoping, 78, 79. So you would say China is economically about 30 years old. Politically, it's about 60 years old, starting from 49 onwards in the new China that we know. But culturally, it's 6,000 years old or more. Similarly, if you look at India, India is an adolescent economically, about 16 years old, 17 today because it started in about liberalization that started in 91, 61 years old politically, given its independence starting in 47, so about 61, and again, 6,000 years old. So when we think about these heady days of commerce, especially in China and India, it behooves us to think about the relationship of economic, political, and cultural, and how this world is literally an oscillating universe in which arts and culture could be at the center, around which, and we have to understand that around which you might have the political and the economic conditions that move. So the purpose of my talk today is to actually explore with you in somewhat preliminary way, because as I said, we're really at the beginning of this journey of exploring this relationship, is to look at the role and place of the arts and culture in relation to the role of the state and the role of commerce as we move forward. I'm very aware, especially in this academic setting, is that it's a tall order for two particular reasons. One is the very word culture. How do we define culture? After all, when we think about culture to our minds, we think of everything from food habits of people to received traditions to the fine arts, the high end of culture with a capital C. On the other hand, culture today, especially in a national sense, is very much a contested terrain. Almost all of us realize that in this age of interdependent globalization, that very idea of national culture has come under tremendous sense of scrutiny because of the fact that it, in fact, that notion of a national identity could go anywhere from national, transnational, as well as diasporic to migrant. Because that purity of culture is probably more suspect today than any other time. So I put that caveat out there, recognizing that there's a problem with this word. But what I would like to do is actually use a particular aspect of culture, which has to do with visual arts. And as Fred said, it's because I'm an art historian, I have to bring that in some way. So this is my way of talking about art, which I normally don't get to talk about very much. So indulge me, if you will, because it'll give me a chance to talk about things that I'm passionate about. But what I do want to do, again, as a historian, is I often feel that the past can provide some understanding for the future as well as for the present. So I want to share with you three key moments in India and China in its art history to try to understand the role of this three-dimensional engagement, role of the arts vis-a-vis the role of royal patronage or state on the one hand and commerce on the other. Now, you might say, why should we do this now? And why is it that my colleagues in China and India are particularly interested that we focus on this issue? And it does have to do with what they feel is the urgency of the matter. And that's because the economic pace of development and change in China especially, but also in India, is so breathtaking that often people feel that what survived for 2,000 years may not survive even 20 years. So how do we look at this issue becomes more important today than perhaps any other time. Just to remind us, and those of you who are not Asianists, because I know lots of you are honor students in very many different fields, is just to recognize how pathbreaking the economic changes are going on in China and India really are. And I want to quote you from, this is from Business Week from August 2006. And it goes like this, and I quote, China and India rarely has the economic ascent of two still relatively poor nations been watched with such a mixture of awe, opportunism, and trepidation. Never has the world seen the simultaneous sustained economic takeoffs of two nations that together account for one-third of the planet's population. Even more profound a statement has been made by Larry Summers, a name that all of you are familiar with from across the river, not only just as a former president of BU of Harvard, but also as a leading economist. And he has stated, and again I quote, that they call it the Industrial Revolution because for the first time in all of human history, standards of living rose at a rate where there were noticeable changes in standards of living in human lifespan, changes of perhaps 50%. So he's talking about the earlier Industrial Revolution in the West. Now think about what's going on in Asia. At current growth rates in Asia, he says, standards of living may rise hundredfold, or 10,000%, in a human lifespan. The rise of Asia and all that follows will be the dominant story in history books written 300 years from now, with Cold War and rise of Islam as secondary stories. It's hard for us to imagine what that's like, but because of this kind of growth and the kind of pace that you're undergoing in these two countries, where today it's expected that the growth rate in both of these countries will range between 8% and 10%, at least through 2010 or so. Again, there might be some hiccups, but the reality is that both of these countries are still at the beginning of the trajectory of the development. These are not mature economies, as I mentioned earlier. So what that means is that you have a way of change that is occurring is unprecedented. And that demands that we look at how it's going to affect arts and culture practices as well as traditional values. As I mentioned, I think that this can also have negative impact. And we know, for example, that more Hutongs, these are the traditional alleys in Beijing, that have more Hutongs have been destroyed since the economic opening of China than in all of the 100 years prior to that time. In India today, there may be, it's been estimated that maybe 225 million Indians are involved in industry, cultural and heritage industry, where it is either traditional performing arts or crafts or making of things. At the rate of 20% to 30%, these people are losing their jobs or their occupation. As Rajiv Sethi, who's a great, great cultural figure in India, has pointed out, that what Mills of Manchester couldn't destroy in 200 years is being destroyed in less than two decades. This is why this question becomes very, very important as we go forward. And as I mentioned, that because this is the beginning of the phase, for the next 20 years or so, you will still see this pace. We know, for example, in China alone, that there is a plan to build 300 new museums in 5 years. In Shanghai, I had an opportunity to talk with the mayor of Shanghai. Prior to the Expo 2010, they want to build 100 new museums. I asked them, what are they going to put in it? That's a different matter. Who's going to be trained to learn to actually run these institutions? That they hadn't thought about. But the point is that it is that kind of a pace is why it's required that you really look at this seriously, carefully, in this context of role of government or the state and the commercial sector. So the three areas and the three historical the kind of periods that I want to look at are the period from, first period is from about 5th century through 9th century, and this is Gupta period in India, 5th through 6th century, and Tang China, height of cosmopolitanism in the early phase of both of these countries. The second period we will look at briefly is Mughal India, that's about 16th, 17th century India, and Ming China, that's about 15th through 16th and early 17th century. And then the third period we'll quickly look at has to do with early independent India, 1950s, 60s, and early revolutionary China, also 50s and 60s. After looking at this frame, I want to come back to the current situation and then explore with you, at least ask the questions of where do we go from here. So let's look at the images. So if you look at Gupta India, 5th, early 6th century, this particular piece is from our own Asia Society's Rockefeller collection. And you see that for Gupta India, as is true of Tang China, these are affluent societies, very strong presence of royal monarchs, kings, emperors, and presence of high-class patrons. Also, very important time for the role of religion and therefore making of images that have to do with religious practices, in this case Buddhist, but also Hindu and Jain as well. And when we look at pieces like this, along with a piece which is one of my all-time favorite Indian images, now in Sarnath Museum, where Buddha gave the site where Buddha gave his first sermon, again, a very beautiful image of late 5th century, what you find is the coalescence of spiritual and sensual coming together and using images like this that then had a tremendous impact all over Southeast Asia and ultimately East Asia as well. So what you're looking at is patronage for pieces like this that came from kings, royal patronage that was also for monasteries, as well as affluent figures that really were the artists, is very much in the service of those patrons and the religious causes. What you see is the same kind of a patterning that happens in Tang China, but Tang China today among intellectuals is seen as, in fact, a very important period where China was cosmopolitan, connected to the outside world, the world was open, and they were able to take influences from all over the world and make it their own. In that sense, China was more international in Tang Dynasty than what we know of Gupta India. And Tang China often can be seen then through this very beautiful torso that has the Indianized quality coming from the Gupta India traditions that I mentioned earlier, but now seen in temple complexes in China. You also will see that that kind of interconnections between India and China is a very strong one, but in China you have connections with Sasanian Empire in Persia, going all the way to the classical world or post-classical world. So China is, in fact, the cosmopolitan city, especially Xi'an, which was the capital of Tang China. And you see that sense of opulence of the aristocratic world through these beautiful ceramics, which were placed in primarily in tombs and burial culture of China, where you really have some sense of beautiful ladies, in this case a musician, or outside elements that come into China, such as these beautiful camels from Bactria, as well as the kind of hat you see, all of which are foreigners with a presence in China. So what here you might think about is that here the role of this fine arts, as is also true of the objects made in these early periods, all has to do primarily with high-end, high patron, royalty, and internationalism. And that internationalism is as much a part of religious transformations and connections that were going on, as you see in this image of Xuanzang, a great Chinese monk who went to India, traveled all around India, and through the help of the Tang Emperor, managed to bring a lot of the sutras back and established a major monastery in Xi'an. The next period is, in fact, the idea of this Ming China, Mughal India, the last period when both of these cultures were at their zenith, and after which things begin to go a little bit more spiraling downward, more so in India than in China. So when we think about China and Ming Dynasty, we're talking about 15th century, 16th century, and early 17th century. On the one hand, you have imperial porcelain, such as this one you see here, underglazed red ceramic, again from the Rockefeller collection. But we also know that these kinds of pieces were then made for different stratas of the society, also had inspired other countries, other cultures, including Europe, but particularly Southeast Asia, in making their own ceramics in the image of the Ming ceramics, such as this vase you see here that is actually from Vietnam in the late 15th, early 16th century, very much inspired by the Chinese tradition. Some of these initially were exported from China, and then gradually they begin to get made in Vietnam itself. The unique thing of China at this period is the maturity of the notion of individual artists. And I want to dwell on this a little because China, more than many, many, many other cultures in East or in the West, has focused on the role of the individual artist, in a way going much farther into history than many other cultures. But it's in the Ming Dynasty where the idea of artists as an intellectual, or intellectual artists as part of the upper strata of the society, not simply as a craftsperson at the service of somebody else, for the patron that one is making the work for, becomes really, really strong. And what you see here then is a new circle of patrons, a new circle of artists who are making paintings for each other as well as showing it to each other. And this is much more the way we think of as a salon in Europe. And this is actually very active in the 16th century in China. And that very idea remains a very important part of the Chinese tradition. And therefore, when we come back to the current period, it's important to think about the role of an individual artist in this context of where the arts are when we think about today. If you look at India, this is also the time when you, for the first time, begin to hear names of individual artists. And this is in Mughal India, the dynasty that begins in mid-16th century, the height of which you might say is in the early 17th to mid-17th century. In this case, what I show you here is the equestrian portrait of Shah Jahan, the great Mughal ruler who also built the Taj Mahal. You will see immediately that this idea of engaging with the outside world is a very important part of the Mughal court. What you see here is the sky that is full of little Italianate kind of angels and putti that you see up above. You'll see the landscape below that almost looks like it's coming from sort of northern Dutch landscape pictures, small images. All of these actually do come from Europe through the Jesuit priest and other great traders who are coming into Mughal court at the time. For the first time, you have the actually an embassy set up by the Brits, and this is in the court of St. James, when we know that the first ambassador who comes to India, primarily for trade purposes, and this is also the time that you should remember that if you put together the GDP of China and India then, it would be almost 50% of world's GDP then. It is where we will be again in probably 2050. So this is sort of the period when economically both of these countries are where everybody else wants to come to. So when Sir Thomas Rowe, the British ambassador, the English ambassador, is in India, he actually writes a note back to the court and saying that please give me the very best gifts you possibly can give me. Because these people have everything. They don't need anything from us, and the emperor is very fussy, and if you don't give me the right thing, I'm not going to get that trading post in Surat. So the use of the arts for the commercial purposes is very strong at this particular time in India. And you also see that because of Mughal emperors' connections to Persia, which is what they see as really their cultural inspiration, there is a strong role of individual artists at the court, and that gets picked up at the Mughal court. So here we know that this painting is done by one of the great Mughal painters, Govardhan, who was known as a leading court painter, and he's using elements from all over the world, from Iran, from Italy, from other European pictures to make a new composite tradition called Mughal art. And that idea of individual artist begins to take hold in India at this time, but it's fair to say that unlike China, these are still court artists, they're at the service of the court, they're making stuff for the emperor, and they're making stuff for the courtiers, or the upper class at the court itself. So you don't have the artist intellectual tradition in India, not until the arrival of the British in India, and it's primarily starting in the early 20th century. The other way the arts get produced at this time is through trade. If Sir Thomas Rowe wanted the best pieces coming from the West into the Indian court, there is also Indian objects that go abroad. So you have this idea of objects that are part of a larger trade that has always been obviously part of the tradition. I do not intend to suggest that this is unusual. What I am trying to say is that the relationship between court or the state and commerce always plays an interesting part, especially in this part of the world, because it remained traditional for much, much longer time than perhaps in other parts of the world. So now I want to move to the next unit, if you will, and that is this early modern period or new revolutionary China from the 1950s and 60s on and newly independent India. If the Gupta and Tang dynasty are age of cosmopolitanism for China and religious role of the arts in both of these countries, if Ming China and Mughal India are about ascendancy of trade and how it gets used on the one hand, and rise of individual artists in China on the other. The 50s and 60s in both countries, I would say, should be called the age of the state. This is the time in both countries where government really feels strongly about the role of the arts in the creation of a state, a modern state. It comes out very differently in both of these countries. It's also fair to say that this is a culmination of nationalist agendas that began in the 20s and 30s in both countries. And then you see it coming to a higher level. And that has to do with sort of the early Maoist ideology that very much focused on art at the service of the state, making of art that would support the revolutionary and nationalist agenda. And we know that Mao actually spoke very, very carefully about this idea of art being at the service of the state. And there are many, many different quotes from Mao Zedong that we know really were applied even prior to the Cultural Revolution, but particularly with the Cultural Revolution in the late 60s. So there is, for example, Mao has said that writers who cling to an individualist or petty bourgeois stand cannot truly serve the masses. No revolutionary writer or artist can do any meaningful work unless he's closely linked with the masses, gives expression to their thought and feelings, and serves them as a loyal spokesman. So from Ming China, with that importance of an artist intellectual, you're now beginning to see that the artist must serve another whole agenda. And work like this, which is this is a very early work, where Mao himself was initially seen as an intellectual, which gradually changes into Mao as an iconic figure. And this notion of service of the state also then begins to be seen as in the service of the cult of Mao, that Mao is the state, as it were. We know that because of that, number of artists suffered greatly. He also focused on really looking at any tradition coming from the past 5,000 years as suspect. Continuation of ink painting as a huge suspect in terms of how this would really serve or not serve the purposes of the state. So while what worked were these social realist kind of posters and prints coming from very much out of the Russian movement and Russian socialist tradition, but the people who really suffered and people who couldn't really do their own work, you might see a work like this and you say, gee, looks like a nice pastoral scene, very delicate, sort of fluid, simple. But this actually belonged to a group of artists called No Name Group. It's because majority of the artists who were at the service of the national state propaganda actually put in their name on it. But the other reason was that this group of artists who really wanted to paint what they saw, they couldn't have done it. So they would go on a bicycle, go to the outskirts, get small pieces of paper, paint little something, put it away, and it would always be small and intimate because if it was bigger, if somebody came and raided your home, you would be in trouble. So this then becomes revolutionary in some ways. And I asked my colleagues or the curators of the show that we just have on, and I said, how did this name, No Name Group, come about? Did they give it themselves? And it turns out that they call themselves No Name after the Cultural Revolution is over, when they show their work for the first time. And people said, what are you going to call yourself? There is a star group, there's all these other groups. So they said, we are the No Name Group. And what this says is that why this was very, very difficult is because, again, Mao and his wife had very much focused on this idea that if artists were focused on artistic quality, it would be a problem. And he said something like this, and I quote, some works which politically are downright reactionary may have a certain artistic quality. The more reactionary their content, and higher their artistic quality, the more poisonous they are to people, and the more necessary it is to reject them. So anything that was for the service of the individual would be a huge problem. So what happens is in the early part of revolutionary China, making of the state with a break from the past is the clear trajectory for China. For India, there is also the desire and aspiration for the creation of a new state, a newly independent post-colonial India. But India goes about it slightly differently. One of the first missions of the new government is to collectively reclaim its past. So while Mao has the break from the past, for Indian officials such as Nehru, in fact, the interest is in building the first major national museum to put the early traditional art into this museum, along with creating a more national modern art gallery that would focus on and celebrate the Indian modernism. Both of this meant that because of its own trajectory of colonial past, how to remove the shackles of colonial power to own India's own ancient history begins to be a very important part of India as a new modern nation. But the other thing that Nehru, especially the first Prime Minister of India, also does is that the building of a modern nation was not just about looking to its past, but also possessing and presenting India into a modern arena that was international. And that's because Nehru himself has the aspiration to be seen as a world leader, not just as a domestic national leader. So while these objects are placed at the National Museum, the other side is building of cities such as Chandigarh, invite Le Corbusier to build a major new city. Why go outside? Because if India was to be a modern nation, this was part and parcel of what India had to do. The other area of this early modernism, as well as mid-modernism, I might call it, in the service of a modern nation, is the development of contemporary and modern art by major figures such as Hussein, as well as Tayyip Mehta, Souza. This particular detail is a very poor detail of an early work by M.F. Hussein. These artists call themselves progressives, and they purposely, like Nehru looking to Corbusier, they are trying to create new work that is modern, that is abstracted. They look to Paul Klee, they look to Picasso to say, we mustn't just focus on the past, we also must focus on the future and the present. And there's an energy, and it's supported by the upper classes in India. And as a result, there is a continuity of patronage of upper classes for modern and contemporary art in India that's completely different from what happens in China. And that brings us to the present. I want to take two elements of contemporary China, and then we'll talk a little bit about India. In China, I would say that there's almost a schizophrenic division between the role of the state in the promotion of the arts and how the arts should be used to project China on the global arena, and the role of commerce, where art gets almost commodified and bought and sold, initially in the international arena, increasingly now also in the Chinese domestic market. So when we see this great bird's nest, I'm sure all of you saw the opening ceremony of the Olympics, an amazing building by Herzog de Meuron, great, great firm that has done many other international designs and art and objects. I think that the very fact that China would use the best of international architects, the best of international artists, wherever they are, bring them together, says something about China's desire to be in the global arena, but also the confidence that it has arrived on the global stage. I think it's very interesting that India, to this day, continues to think about if there is a major commission, it's always a discussion, why shouldn't it be given to an Indian artist? Why shouldn't it be given to an Indian architect? So this kind of a nationalist tendencies come back all the time, partly because I think India is not in the same place on the global stage as China is, nor has the state figured out in India how to project itself in the global arena using the power of the arts. So you not only have the great, great architecture from all over. In Beijing, you see today, you arrive and there is one of the most fantastic airports designed by Norman Foster. You have buildings by Rem Koolhaas. You name it, they're there. And that is one of the things that is really changing the character of the arts and architecture in China with the patronage of the state. The other spectrum is the commercial development of contemporary art scene in China. As late as 10 years ago, there was still a movement of artists who were trying to push against the establishment to look at social commentary to the art. Today, it's fair to say that majority of the artists are really focused on how to make more money because their time has come and the age of commerce has arrived for them. When we first did our major show, Inside Out, in 1998, we started working on it in 1994, you went to artist studios who today are multimillionaires in tiny little cubbyhole of apartments, where they were really trying to figure out how to make art and to be true to their spirit. Some of that spirit, I'm afraid, is beginning to disappear from China. And at the same time, you also have huge explosion of various museums, including private museums, such as the Yulin's Museum, Guy Yulin, who has a museum in that same art district where he's bringing Western art. You know that Arnie Glimcher and other major American dealers, Saatchi, London dealer, are all going to China to capitalize on that art market. So there is this notion of commodification of art that is underway in China today, unlike almost any other time. It's also fair to say that artists are able to do pretty much anything as long as they don't criticize the party. So there is a kind of a self-censorship that is operating that allows them to do their commercial path. And then when people like Zhang Yimou get asked by the government to do something, he knows what the boundaries are. So there is a greater degree of self-censorship of the artists and art in China today than you might have seen 15 years ago. And that's something that really makes it harder for Chinese artists to make art that still continues to push against the norms and conventions of what is appropriate or sells. Compared to that in India, you have at least some artists who actually are socially and politically much more aware. And that has something to do with the political system. If in China, the role of the state is very powerful in projecting arts on the international arena, as well as the national scale, in India, the government has not quite made up its mind, I would say. But it's also fair to say that government is trying to get out of this business of the support of the arts, partly because it's a drag on the economy, as they see it. In India, there's also a thriving art scene, and contemporary art today is very, very hot. Today, I'm told that in India, at art school, the admission application is much higher than ever before, as is true in China, because the parents are saying that if you can't do math and science, art is a good field because you'll be rich. And in India, what that means is that, of course, if you're the best students, you go into math and sciences and engineering and those fields, or commerce, business world. And if you have any artistic inclination, they say, okay, go to art school, get the money, and start now. So it's become a job. And that has meant that the commercially things are thriving because more people are buying it. There's a greater degree of patronage for these arts, but Indian art still remains more insular compared to the Chinese art, because Chinese artists early on had no domestic market. So they began to engage with the outside world much earlier. And as a result, they're part of the international scene in a way that often Indian contemporary art still is not. It will change, but we will see when that shifts. So there are still artists in India who really focus on political, socially aware art. And because of the political system in India, it's possible. They can make fun of political leaders. They can make fun of the system. They can push against the system as it exists. And that makes it possible to have an alternative art scene in India to a level that one feels is not completely feasible in China. So when we come to contemplating about the future, obviously one of the areas that both countries have to deal with is the future of the past. What to do with its 6,000-year-old civilizations. Both in China and India, in China somewhat late, but it has begun, such as this fantastic Shanghai Museum that has now become a world-class museum, collecting many different kinds of traditional Chinese art. In India, you still continue to have things like the National Museum. But what's happening that's interesting in China is that the government has thought about corporate sponsorship as one of the ways to infuse these traditional institutions. Whereas in India, they're still debating whether culture can be part of commerce. As much as there is a whole commercial establishment, how to bring the sponsorship in, what is the role of public-private partnership, both countries still are struggling with as they go forward. So one of the things that we should look out for is that what would be the nature of the public-private partnership for strengthening of institutions in both countries as they go forward? What would be the future of the past? In other words, how will these young economies, mature political structures, will deal with their ancient traditions? The third piece, for China especially, is to think about the role of an artist or an individual. And for China, this is not a new question. We think of that as only a current political phenomenon. But as early as in Tang Dynasty, a great poet who is known in the Tang Dynasty actually raised this question. And I want to leave you with this poem that he wrote. And it goes like this. Sent as a present from Annam, which is present-day Vietnam, a red cockatoo, colored like the peach tree blossom, speaking with the speech of men. and they did to it what is always done to the learned and the eloquent. They took a cage with stout bars and shut it up inside. Just think about that idea in the 8th century. It's still a question in China, what will happen to those individual voices? For both countries, I would say there is also the peril of preservation. How to look at the past without being nostalgic? How to learn from the past? Is it a challenge that you have this ancient history? Or is it an opportunity? An opportunity that actually may allow you to do something new to create what Homi Bhabha has called the third space. Using the past into the present to create a new future. Not hybrid, but actually merging things that can come to a new level. And I do feel that for many of these countries, sometimes it feels like the past is a burden. But perhaps the past can be an opportunity. In India, there is the issue that we take our legacy for granted. But the pace of development is such that you cannot take that for granted anymore. Support for contemporary culture that goes beyond the past but uses the past might be another way to create a whole new world that doesn't look like everything that we've seen before. So I, for one, am excited about thinking about this future, but also worried. Thank you very much.
Dr. Vishakha Desai, President and CEO of Asia Society, speaking on Boston University's World of Ideas. Dr. Desai's lecture was sponsored by the College of Arts and Sciences Honors Program and titled The Future of Culture in the Age of Commerce, China and India. She was introduced by Art History Department Chair Fred Kleiner. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Jared Mooney. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.